from Wondery. I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. Today, we wrap our series on the battle between toy giants Hasbro and Mattel. We've gone back almost 70 years to the 1950s, to a time when both of these companies were just fresh-faced newbies. Nothing like the multi-billion dollar businesses they are today. And although Hasbro and Mattel sell toys, the money they rake in, well, it's definitely not child's play. In fact, $80 billion now spent on toys every year. Sean McGowan has been following the toy industry for 30 years. He's currently managing director at Lyolis. We're bringing him in on the show to bring us up to date on all things toys today. Sean McGowan, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on Business Wars.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You know, this is one of the more fun aspects of doing this Business Wars podcast is getting to talk to people who are passionate about their industries. And you're certainly that. How did you get such a cool gig, basically staying on top of the toy business?
It's kind of funny how I fell into doing toys. I was a French major, or double major, French and English in college. And my first job out was with an accounting firm doing basic research on companies that they either had a relationship with or wanted a relationship with. One of the clients of the firm was Coleco Toys of Cabbage Patch fame.
Yeah.
And they were involved in trying to buy Milton Bradley. So the partner in the Hartford, Connecticut office called up and said, I need to know everything there is to know about the U.S. toy industry so I can sound smart to my client. And so we spent 2 weeks on that, you know, and then moved on. The next project was probably, you know, something completely unrelated. But getting out of business school in 1986, I put that down just as an example
yeah.
of the kind of work that I had done for that 1 year that I was working for Coopers and Lybrand. And I happened to be, you know, noticed by a guy who came out of Warner, the old, you know, pre-Time Warner.
Yeah.
They owned a piece of Hasbro, and they, you know, formerly had the video game company Atari. So the idea was, hey, maybe this kid knows something about the toy industry, and we'll hook him up. So if I hadn't put that on my resume, I'd probably be an oil analyst.
That's incredible. That is incredible.
But it worked out.
Yeah, I'll say it worked out.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts. Things haven't always been so rosy for the toy industry itself. I mean, I guess one of the big stories out of the industry is the bankruptcy and closing of Toys R Us, right? I mean, for our listeners, what happened to the retailer and what's it done to the industry?
Well, first on what happened to Toys R Us, you know, clearly the buyout that happened in 2005, I think it was, saddled the company with more debt than it can handle.
Right.
From an operating standpoint, things weren't all that bad. They weren't all that good either. They were clearly losing market share to the Walmarts and, you know, certainly Amazon and even Target. You know, so I won't say that all of the problem was financial, but that level of leverage did prevent them from making some of the investments that I think they could have been making and should have been making to be more competitive in online. You know, ultimately, you have to be profitable in toys if your only business is toys, whereas some of these other retailers don't necessarily have to be profitable in toys, and they don't need to be profitable all year round. So that was, you know, maybe a structural challenge that had always been in place.
Yeah.
But you put the debt on top of that and, you know, see a lot of consumers leaving the brick and mortar business to go to online, and that created another challenge. But the expectation was certainly that, okay, if Toys R Us is going to go away, you know, consumers aren't going to want less toys. They're just going to buy them somewhere else. So I think on the part of most of the executives of big toy companies, they figured that 80 or 90% or maybe even all of it of the business lost to Toys R Us would be absorbed by other retailers in relatively short time.
So what actually happened? In fact,
it's not what happened. I think maybe 60% of those sales were absorbed by Amazon and Walmart and Target. And you also had a whole bunch of other retailers jump in the business thinking, you know, there's a lot of market share up for grab here and I'll stake my claim. So you had Best Buy. You had Kohl's, you had JCPenney, even Macy's. You know, a lot of retailers who really were not a factor in toys jumping in and trying to grab some of that share. Party City opened up Toy City, you know, pop-up stores. The problem with that, though, was that these are all retailers that have the attitude, well, on December 26th, I pretty much want to have no inventory.
Mm-hmm.
So they really didn't buy as much as Toys R Us would have bought for the same level of sales, because Toys R Us doesn't want zero inventory on December 26th. They know that consumers are coming back in January to redeem, you know, gift cards or to exchange product. So it was a bad trade. You know, if you're trading a dollar of revenue from Toys R Us for a dollar at one of these newbies that really doesn't want to be in the business all year, you're going to lose out. And I think really what happened too is during the period of the liquidation, call it April and May of 2018, and this wasn't known until after the fact, but there seemed to be a lot of what came to be known as pantry loading, you know, where people would go and see the not only their liquidation sales, but the response by competitors, you know, lowering prices in the face of that competition. You know, a lot of people went in April, May and say, look, I'll buy this stuff super cheap, stick it in the back of the closet, you know, and bring it out. And you know, that way save myself a lot of money. And I think some of the toy companies said publicly they didn't think that was going on because, you know, they did surveys that showed that a lot of those toys were consumed, if you will, like given away or used as gifts.
Right.
But I think, and again, in hindsight, what happened was just because they were given away, you know, in August doesn't mean that they were going to come back and buy toys later in the season. You know,
boy,
it could be that a kid wanted XYZ toy. He got it earlier and they bought something else, you know, when the holiday season really came. So I think that there was a lot of soul searching after the holiday season, with a lot of the manufacturers saying, what are we going to do? And you haven't seen the end of the impact, because a lot of these companies were shipping to Toys R Us in the first quarter of 18, and you had this disruption in the second quarter of 18. So we haven't yet seen the year-over-year comparisons be clean yet.
Well, this is still a big deal any way you slice it. I mean, it sounds like Toys R Us was it really put a crater in the marketplace for toys. But what I keep hearing little whispers that Toys R Us may be revived or resuscitated. You know, Jeffrey, the giraffe, seems to be popping up here and there. Have you heard any of this stuff?
Oh, certainly I've heard the stories of a revival of Toys R Us, and some of the executives that were involved in Toys R Us have put together a plan for, you know, kind of a revived or transformed Toys R Us.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably logic to the idea that there is a place in the market for a dedicated, you know, expert toy retailer, that because, you know, the debt really is what killed the old Toys R Us, and a kind of a stale format of 35,000 square foot boxes that were no longer located where it was that consumers were shopping.
People wanted
this
to go.
Part of the problem. Yeah, I mean, they were built on the way to the mall. Like, that was the idea. They were never in the mall or part of the mall, but they were like a quarter of a mile away from the mall.
Right.
So they were built on roads that were on the way to the mall. Well, if the consumer's not going to the mall, you're not getting that traffic.
Mm-hmm.
So the new Toys R Us, or, you know, whatever they wind up calling it, would be smaller stores with more flexible real estate, Focused on products that, you know, not necessarily everything from everybody, but, you know, more curated selection. Yeah. It's going to face a couple of challenges, though. One is that these are the same people that brought you the old Toys R Us. and to some degree, you got to at least recognize that. And secondly, a very significant portion of the old Toys R Us' sales were private label. And part of the strategy here, because those are, you know, brand names that they created and owned, part of the strategy of this revived Toys R Us is to make that a big part of it. But those kinds of private label products, and this is true of any retailer, really only sell if you've already got the traffic. And if you're not getting the support of all the vendors of the name brand products, you're not really going to benefit from selling the private label. So, you know, I'd say there's some, you know, challenges that that revival will face. But at the same time, the manufacturers recognize they need whatever they can to recapture some of those lost sales. So I imagine that they'll get some support. You know, certainly if they pay in advance, they'll get that support. You know, and if it's successful over time, they'll get continued support from the vendors.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the players in the industry. And, of course, during this series for Business Wars, we've been focused on Hasbro and Mattel as the primary competitors going way back. First, let's talk about Hasbro. Where are they right now, given what's happened to the marketplace for toys? I mean, what's that company's big play right now?
Yeah, Hasbro has been undergoing its own successful transformation over the last decade or so under the leadership of Brian Goldner in redefining itself as not just being a toy company, but a, you know, consumer-focused play company or entertainment company. Toys are part of the expression of what comes out of the IP that they own. Mm-hmm. They own several properties like Transformers, G.I. Joe, you know, Mr. Potato Head, things that they own outright. And then there are others where they have long-term relationships. They call them partner brands. So the product offering isn't simply the plastic plaything that everybody knows, but it's, you know, licensed merchandise, other categories, other expressions, you know, through web-oriented games or their own animated content. They did a joint venture with Discovery to do television content. They're still doing that. So it's really a redefinition of what a modern kid-oriented entertainment company can be, and that's been largely successful. The demise of Toys R Us has been painful, and they have lost some sales, and they've seen some of the properties that they depend on have not perhaps performed as reliable as they have in the past. For example, if you're doing a Star Wars movie literally every year, not every one of them is created equal, and Han Solo movie is not going to do what Episode 7 or 8 did. So
some things will work, some won't.
Yeah, there's been some choppiness to that, but generally speaking, they've done a great job over the course of the last 10-15 years of expanding geographically, focusing on mega brands, kind of super brands, keeping expenses in line with where they should be, keeping the balance sheet relatively clean, and I think they're in a good position, and they've gone from being the number two company to being the number two company, because quietly Lego has surpassed both Hasbro and Mattel.
That is amazing.
So while the rivalry is always, Hasbro versus Mattel, Lego now is pretty comfortably in the lead because they were able to show growth in 2018 and both Hasbro and Mattel saw revenue declines.
Well, hold off on Lego, because we got to talk about Lego in just a moment, And it's interesting, too, that you mentioned Lego because, and of course, the strategy, the old Toys R Us strategy, where they were away from the mall, and now, Lego is in your face. They're in every mall I can think of right off the top of my head. And it's, it's become almost a lifestyle brand kind of thing for kids. But I want to back up into Mattel. What has changed there, and have they moved on to adopt something similar to Hasbro's sort of we're the play brand?
I would say that the Mattel playbook looks a lot like the Hasbro playbook now, to the extent that they are in a position to imitate that. If you go back, and they've had multiple CEO changes in the last half decade, so go back a few CEOs ago, and Mattel could be characterized as a company with a small number of very strong, very profitable brands that they owned. They own Barbie, they own Fisher-Price, they own Thomas the Tank Engine, they own Hot Wheels, they own American Girls. Those are big, super profitable brands.
Right.
But over time, each one of them faced a number of challenges. And oh, by the way, tucked in there, at one point was Monster High, which isn't really a factor anymore, but came in from nothing to, I was thinking it was $500 million at its peak.
Yeah, it was a huge
hit. Super profitable. Yeah, it was a huge hit, and it was very profitable because they owned it and, you know, didn't have to pay a royalty to anybody. And they had the license for Disney Princess, which was also a very significant piece of business. So, kind of recapping the last couple of years, Monster High went away, and a lot of that revenue might have been expected to trickle back into other fashion dolls, and some of it did, some of it didn't. And then they lost Disney Princess, and, you know, that was a significant loss. Fisher-Price got, you know, saw a lot of increase in competition from other brands. Fisher-Price is really a product line that is purchased by parents rather than by kids, and it's really purchased by parents for the functionality. You know, you have a kid of a certain age, you need a product that Fisher-Price sells, but it's that decision is not based on, you know, some kid in the aisle of the toy store holding his breath.
Yeah, you're not selling the kid.
Yeah, the kid can't speak. So, you know, I don't think you got that same degree of predictability, or you couldn't market it the same way, and they lost some market share. They probably overpriced themselves. This is by their admission. You know, they overpriced themselves relative to some of the competition. So you saw challenges at Fisher-Price. American Girl, I think, got a little overextended. You know, behind the scenes, the numbers looked great for a bunch of years, but looking behind those numbers, you saw that a lot of that growth was coming from opening new American Girl stores, you know, and at some point that hits a wall. You can't have them everywhere. Mm-hmm. So you've seen declines at Fisher-Price, declines at American Girl, declines at Barbie. Hot Wheels kind of, you know, did okay, but would go up and down. Like if Cars was in the theater, Hot Wheels would go down. When Cars left the theater, Hot Wheels would go back up. Now, they had the Cars license, but that's not as profitable because they have to pay a big license. So, you know, the strategy of relying on a relatively small number of high profit margin categories works when those categories are doing well, and it's a problem when they're not. Looking at it last year, they did quite well with Barbie, didn't do as well with some other properties, and really took it on the chin with Toys R Us disappearing.
Right. You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind. You know, listeners, you know, we've been talking about the Disney Princess toys, and that's an incredible chapter unto itself. And if you haven't heard the story, if somehow you missed episode 6 in the series, you got to go back and hear what happened with the loss of the Disney Princess toys, lost to Mattel, and Hasbro's victory in winning that over. It really is epic. Now you got Hasbro, and you've got Mattel.
I'm familiar with it. Yeah, I'm familiar
I know you are. It's just spectacular. spectacular. Yeah. It's just an incredible case study. Now, but you have Hasbro and you have Mattel, giant toy companies. But as you were saying, there's a company that's gotten even bigger, and Lego is what we're talking about here. I remember, and it wasn't that long ago, Lego was not what you'd call a really, a major contender. I mean, it was having some tough times as a business not that long ago. So what changed?
A couple of things changed. Let's go back to when they were struggling. I mean, it's been a great brand, recognized around the world for decades. You know, that's not new.
Right.
And, you know, multiple generations of kids. So, you know, you could conceivably be getting kids Lego products for your grandkids that reminded you of when you had them yourself, because that's how long they've been around.
Mm-hmm.
And they've always done their own manufacturing, so their profit margins were relatively high. But where they really stumbled a while ago was doing some licenses but not really executing them very well, and kind of approached their retail partnerships with a level of arrogance that was, you know, there's the Lego way or the highway. You know, kind of, we know what we're doing. You don't.
Yep.
Let us do our thing. And they've always been extremely strong in certain European markets. Like, I would think that the average German consumer assumes that Lego is a German company because that's how big their presence is in Germany.
Amazing.
Of course, it's Danish. So, you know, globally, they were a factor. There are many countries where their sales would be higher than any of the other two guys. But their costs were too high. You know, their prices to the retail customers were too high, and their licenses were a little bit off. And then you had a management change, and you had a guy come in from the outside for the first time, a non-family member running the company. I think he came from McKinsey. And it was like a death scare, because he basically said, look, we can turn this thing around, or we're going to have to sell this company. And, you know, the idea of selling or breaking down or splitting up Lego scared the bejesus out of a lot of the employees. And I have never seen a turnaround as rapid and as thorough as that turnaround. So and from a product standpoint, a number of things changed. The licenses started to focus more on kind of big Hollywood properties. At the same time, there was also a lot of growth in the core non-licensed product. It wasn't all license-driven, but a lot of it was. You
just
had
the
Lego
building
Friends.
Blocks. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
The basic
core products. Patterns like City, you know, like the City line or, you know, Space lines, things that weren't really licensed but did extremely well. Friends, you know, really tapped into a whole part of the segment that
Lego
never
Friends.
Got done before. Licensing to the video game companies introduced the property, you know, to a whole, maybe, or reintroduced the property to kids who had either moved away or had never really gotten involved in it. And those were extremely well done. Properties like Ninjago and, you know, some of the other follow-ups where you had animated content in addition to, you know, this really deep, rich backstory against it had not been done before. And the figures really are an essential part of it. The figures were not brand new. The figures had been introduced, I think, in maybe the 70s or 80s. But the diversity of the figures and the expressiveness of the figures are a big part of it. And it's a lot easier to tell a story and make even the basic Legos, you know, story-oriented when you have these figures.
Yeah, talk about telling a story. I mean, yeah, they've got the movie franchise now, and it's huge. A new Lego movie is announced, and every kid I know wants to go see it.
And when they first announced the Lego movie, you know, before you saw any of the footage, and maybe you heard about some of the people who were involved, it wasn't obvious that it was going to be either as successful as it was or as high quality as it was. It'd be kind of easy to imagine that being a dud. Of course, it wasn't. It was phenomenally entertaining. Probably should have won an award. It's easy to watch, and it's easy to see how anybody of any age could really enjoy that. So that helped a lot. You know, when you look at the sales around that movie, definitely gave it a lift. You know, each of the subsequent movies has had less of an impact, but still, you know, successful by any definition. And that is where they're still doing the video games. So it's a kind of a combination of a whole bunch of things together. And I think they had gone through a period there where they they subcontracted out some of their production for the first time, you know, actually had layoffs for the first time. Well, they've taken all their production back in-house. So you see their gross margins are far higher than any other company. Their operating margins are far, far higher. Even when they struggled, you know, even like you have to say the last, I don't know, 4 years have not been as super successful as the prior, you know, 10, but relative to the rest of the industry, they've certainly done extremely well.
I have to ask you on a personal level, Sean. I mean, I'm assuming that you had toy favorites growing up. I mean, knowing the business inside and out the way that you do, Are you still as passionate about toys or all grown up now?
You should see my office, David. It's got nothing but toys and baseball paraphernalia. I do remember a couple of favorites. You know, Hot Wheels was a favorite. We had tracks, you know, lining the bedroom. I shared a bedroom with my two brothers.
Yeah.
Major Matt Mason. I'd say every other year, I'd say to Mattel, you got to do Major Matt Mason. It's due for a comeback.
Mind blown.
Yeah, G.I. Joe was a big deal.
Yeah, sure.
Legos, I mean, we had one box. You know, my mother got this one box. She decorated the outside of it with the covers of comic books. You know, it was a big box. I want to say that it was from a liquor store, but that would taint my mother somehow. And it was into that we dumped all of our Legos. And back then, you'll recall, that Legos were not, the pieces weren't so specialized. You know, it was just like mostly basic pieces. If they were, we didn't buy them because they were probably too expensive. So we had this one giant box of Legos, and there were certain parts that were really valuable, and you could, you know, we only had a number of them. I mean, it was just one more thing that my brothers and I fought over. But that was the thing that we probably loved the longest, you know, and deep into teenage years. Like, you got to love Lego. So it's just kind of funny how some of the stuff is still, you know, we're still talking G.I. Joe, we're still talking Hot Wheels, we're still talking Lego.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's still people who remember fondly Stretch Armstrong. Of course, there's still lots of Barbie fans who have, you know, grown up into their adulthood. They're still collecting Barbies. And of course, Mr. Potato Head, an epic toy going back to the 50s for Hasbro. My Little Ponies out there. Are there any toys coming out now or that have come out in the last couple of years that you think might have that same kind of staying power that, you know, maybe, you know, I'm wondering beyond just breakout toys, like, you know, Monster High just came and then it went. I'm wondering, what's that next? You think there is a marquee brand out there that's, you know, that, I mean, do you sense anything like that?
I thought that perhaps Bratz had that potential for this reason, that what it stood for was everything that Barbie wasn't. You know, it was sort of the anti-Barbie. So as long as there was Barbie, there would be the foil of Barbie, you know, Batman versus Joker kind of thing. But it maybe partly because of the lawsuits and maybe just, you know, kids' tastes are unpredictable, it really hasn't lasted. I would say, you know, one, it's not really toys, but, you know, Funko is a company that makes collectible figurines that look a lot like toys. They're probably purchased more by adults, you know, so maybe they're not played with, but they're collected. And I think that the driving force behind that is this innate desire that consumers have to connect with a physical product, to connect to entertainment content that they really love. And that's not going away. In fact, it's going up because consumers' access to entertainment content has never been greater, and it just goes up every year. You can't keep track of it. You used to be able to watch like all of the primetime stuff. You can't keep track of all the entertainment content that there is out there that you could buy stuff for. So I could see the Funko Pop line being something that, It's 9 years old and it's still growing. It grew at over 30% last year. I could see that being, you know, something that we're still talking about, you know, years into the future.
You know, that's a really good point. That's such an interesting point because I know people, my 13-year-old son collects those Funko. These are, for people who haven't seen these are like small, maybe 4-inch tall action figure looking things that are not intended to be played with like you might G.I. Joe or something. They're just sort of there to sit on your desk and maybe bob their heads if they have that feature, right? They're just sort of there.
Yeah, exactly. And because they're all the same size and have a common look, you know, you can tell that what they're supposed to be based on the license, but there's a common look to them. Mm-hmm. You can have, you know, your Bob Ross guy can interact with your Deadpool guy. In fact, Bob Ross can be Deadpool. They actually did that. You know, but I got Mike Trout. He can be next to Darth Vader, and it's the same world, and it makes sense because they're the same scale and they have the same look. And as the company likes to say, everybody's a fan of something, and I think that's the real secret. Is that even if you don't watch this particular show or don't like that movie or that comic book, everybody's got something, either from their childhood or teenage years or the present that they connect with. I was talking to my wife about, you know, this company. She's like, who the heck, what adult would buy this product? I'm like, you know, you were a college gymnast. Wouldn't you buy a little figure of Olga Corbett or Nadia Comaneci or something? She's like, well, yeah, only one. I'm like, yeah, well, that's all it takes. You know, everybody's got one thing at least that they want. And, you know, we'll see. That seems to be the thing that has you know, the greatest, that's probably the best growth story in the toy industry over the last decade, and you know, doesn't show any signs of slowing down. And it's global. You know, that's the thing too about the entertainment content now, is everybody's got access to Netflix and everybody's got access to all these sources. So, you know, a show that's really popular in Brazil can be really popular everywhere. You know, and certainly most of it seems to come out of the U.S. So if you're selling product tied to those things, you can sell them anywhere.
Sean, you know something? I thought that you might say, you know, I wasn't thinking Funko, and that's really an interesting suggestion. I thought that you might suggest something that was like related to video games or maybe gaming or technology, because technology has changed so much of, you know, it's changed how we consume entertainment, it's changed how we listen to music and how we watch movies. And I wonder if it's doing the same kind of, it's causing the same kind of upheaval in the toy industry, but it doesn't sound like necessarily so. It's, that's more the licensing aspect.
But I would say that what you were saying is almost a given. You know, the gaming's been around now for 40 years,
right?
Plus, right. So it's not like this is a new trend, and I think people don't age out of gaming as quickly as they enter that funnel. Mm-hmm. You know, there's more kids growing into gaming than are growing out of gaming. So yes, gaming has definitely got a bigger footprint. You know, does video game revenues exceed box office now for the first time? And it's ubiquitous. Like anybody who's got that device, whatever it is, in their pocket's got access to gaming and access to free gaming. So I think that it's kind of a given, and maybe I should have started with that, is that the impact of gaming as a lifestyle choice and as something that pervades everywhere is certainly being felt, and its impact is being felt in the toy industry. But I think a lot of the impact on the toy industry was probably felt, you know, like at 10 or 20 years ago. In other words, if you're going to siphon away the interest of the 8 years old, that they're already out. You know, it's the impact is not really, the kid who's now 20 is not otherwise going to be buying toys. The kid who's now 30 is not otherwise going to be buying toys. And the impact on the younger kids, you know, probably year over year comparison is probably unchanged. Now, when you take something like Fortnite, you know, it comes in and all of a sudden there's a lot of girls interested in Fortnite that might not otherwise have been playing video games. You know, that can have an impact.
Yeah,
you know,
of course
that's definitely like an incremental leg up, and that can have some impact.
You know, it's so interesting, and you've been awfully generous with your time, Sean. It's fun to think about how the toy industry continues to evolve, and in a way, no longer is it something that we grow out of, but in fact, we kind of grow into, especially as you were describing, you know, gaming.
And I think that this idea of being a geeky collector has come out as being something that people no longer feel they need to hide. You know, it used to be when you got together, you know, on a Monday morning, let's say you were a 35-year-old and you got together on Monday morning in the office, the thing you probably talked about was the football game the day before. And people are not ashamed to talk about some really, you know, geeky Game of Thrones conversations are probably more common than what the football game was the day before. And having that expression, like, I'm going to buy this product, or I'm going to wear this T-shirt, or I'm going to discuss how eagerly I'm anticipating the next show, that's not something people shy away from. And I think the reason is everybody's got something that they're crazy about, you know, whether it's, you know, Stranger Things or Lost or, you know, binge-watching Friends, which, you know, like, how long has it been since there was really a new episode of Friends? And you've got a whole new generation binge-watching Friends and talking about it. So the, you know, taking it from sort of this thing I'm ashamed to admit I do at home to I'm proud to display how I'm spending my time and how I'm spending my money, that's been a big cultural change. It's no longer just, you know, ashamed geeks that are driving the economic force here. It's people who are proud to display those things they're passionate about.
Sean McGowan is a longtime toy industry expert, as you can tell. And Sean, it's been a lot of fun getting a chance to talk about the industry with you. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on Business Wars.
Always a pleasure, David. Thank you.
That was our conversation with toy industry analyst Sean McGowan. He's managing editor at Lyolus. Next time on Business Wars, rev up those engines because we're driving into a whole new series on Ferrari versus Lamborghini. Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Thanks so much for listening to Business Wars. New episodes come out every Monday and Wednesday. Business Wars is hosted by yours truly, David Brown. This episode was produced by Katie Long and Megan Monaco for Wondery.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.